see. I can't really hear myself talking. There is no sound. It's on, it's not muted. So, a button somewhere. Hi. There is no sound. No. There should be a panel controlling the lights. We don't want lights up at the blackboard. Yeah. So sound.
Yes.
Wow. And this one doesn't work. No. So now everyone can hear me. Yes. Okay. Good enough for me. Do you need this during the introduction? Then you can.
No. Those who come will come, and I'll talk, and we'll do questions afterwards.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So that was cool stuff, and we wanted to do that, but since there is nothing.
so maybe we skip it, so
yeah, we'll
do it in
year.
January. Yeah. Sorry, didn't know. Always a surprise.
You never know what students are doing, but having exams is a good excuse.
Yeah, I think so. One of the best you can have, I think.
Okay, well.
Antique.
What?
The last antique.
Yes.
Well, soon we're going to be entering you, then there will be no heat.
So yeah, this will be a rarity at some point.
You should keep it.
Well, I guess we're just very few, but very exquisite. Yeah, I'm thinking we have one of the nicest selection of staff, though we are missing out a little bit on the students today, but we have... Okay, well, this is better.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have a professor from NTNU who's going to give the last NIST lecture this year, Christian Justin. He's in the Department of Mathematical Science, and will usually he speaks a lot about cryptography, but today he will speak about the e-voting experiments in Norway. When I was traveling to Switzerland and Brussels before, I was also advertising this lecture, and everybody kept saying, oh, so they're doing it in Norway. And then I was like, no, it's actually not work. It did not work. So I'm very excited actually about the lessons learned from this, and I hope we can, or I'm sure we can hear some exciting insights now. So welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. Like I said earlier, this is the main office visiting. But when it comes to security, it's the district office visiting the main office, of course. So I'm a mathematical cryptologist, but somehow I got tangled into this internet voting. Let me start by saying a bit about the background. Then I'm going to talk very briefly about all the beautiful cryptography involved in voting. I can't not talk about it, of course. Then I'll talk a bit about developers and then people in general. And you'll notice I haven't put beautiful in front of developers. I haven't put beautiful in front of people. So, Norwegian elections, they're run by municipalities. They're responsible for doing the elections. The central government will assist them, and in 2008 the central government decided that we need some electronic voting stuff. So they started a project, and it was supposed to do three things. It was supposed to produce an electronic electoral roll, so that when you get to any polling place you can be marked off as having voted. And that simplifies things for people. They also wanted a system for scanning and counting paper ballots. And then they decided, let's have a go at remote electronic voting, where you sit at home and you vote from home. Only advanced voting. Now, I was involved in this project. I will only talk about the remote voting part. The other parts, kind of boring. I should mention that no one probably has done a proper security analysis of those things yet, so please go ahead. Politics. I mean, this is elections, and it turns out when it comes to elections, politicians, they are domain experts. They know about elections. They care about elections. Usually when you go to a politician and you talk about security, they don't care. But when you go to politicians and you talk about security in elections, they care. They know what this is about. And it turns out in 2010, when the project was well underway and everything was going along fairly well, it suddenly turned out the opposition was very much against this project. They said, no, no, absolutely not. And it turned out basically a majority of the government parties, government coalition, was also against it. And then obviously, this is politics, a majority in parliament voted for the trials, not against them. So everyone was against it, but it turns out we did it anyway. I don't pretend to understand this, but this is what happens. So this is a bit about the background. It's a project, it was controversial, and we tried to do some stuff here. What do we care about? If you look at all the regulations governing our paper elections, our current elections, there are some things you realize we care about in Norway. We care about secrecy of the vote. No one should know what you voted. You are free to tell people what you voted, but you shouldn't be able to actually prove what you voted. It's secret whether you voted. Not as secret as what you voted, but you're not allowed to go down to City Hall and ask to see the list of who voted in the last election. That's confidential. And we really like for people not to be forced to vote something they don't want to vote, which is why we have these enclosures. You go into this place, you vote, you select your ballot, you modify it in private, and then you put it in the ballot box. Now, I like to say that we don't trust our government not to mess up. Obviously not, which is why we care a lot about integrity. In other countries, people do not really trust their government not to cheat. In Norway, I think I am on fairly solid ground when I say Norwegians, we trust our government not to try to cheat us. Which means when you go to international conferences and you hear the talks on electronic voting, there's always this enormous amount of work on verifiability. No one cares about it in Norway. Okay, so these are some of the things that govern the project. Let's talk about coercion a bit. In Norway, coercion is not a man with a gun. In other countries, that's coercion. But in Norway, that's not it. The coercer is really a nice guy helping you. That's what it is. Your wife is looking over your shoulder while you're voting, and she's helping you make the right choice. And I mean, when your wife has kind of guided you into a correct choice, you may not want to go to the police and say, I was coerced. But it may be easier for you to say, well, I wasn't coerced, of course, but I changed my mind. I didn't want to vote that after all. So one of the really important things is that you have an effective means of avoiding coercion that doesn't require a lot of preparation, that doesn't require explicit actions to undo a previous ballot or something like this. It must be the one who uses this option must be able to do it without actually being preventing coercion. He must be able to think about it in some other way. Okay, so after a while, you end up with a long list of requirements. I'm going to go very quickly through these. The social scientists, the election researchers, those who don't do crypto, they really care about the first one here. Just because you no longer vote on paper shouldn't change the outcome of the election. That's really important for them. And one of the things that they kind of remarked in some of the prototypes was the fact that you could search for candidates. So you could simply type in, say, your own last name, and then you could mark off all those people. And that would be very different from paper voting, where you actually have to go look at all the ballots and you have to find out where they are and whatever. And that might change voting patterns. So things like this was important. Apparently, we had socialists in government when this project happened. And socialists, turns out, they care about open source. Not because of the reasons we as security people care about open source. We care because we can look at the code. They care for moral whatever reasons. So this push for openness, and this was really important in the project, had several motivations. Some cared for ideological reasons, others cared for security reasons. It was very good to have these socialists there. Secrecy and integrity, obvious, but there's a big infrastructure behind electronic voting. We should be able to tolerate a certain amount of compromise in that infrastructure. I'll come back to all of these things. So we have a long list of security requirements, and then the government is trying to buy something. And we all know government IT projects late and over budget. And this is, I should say that electronic voting is kind of an easy one. It isn't like all the other places. It isn't a huge project, it isn't this, but this project was run on time and under budget, I think. So it was a rather complicated thing called a competitive dialogue, konkurransepreget dialog in Norwegian. There were 5 rounds. The vendors were invited in and said, hey, come tell us what we need, and we'll tell you what we want, and we'll talk about it. And then there was a progressive, more detailed, and early we saw lots of variety in what the proposals looked like. Later, it turned out everyone handed in essentially the same thing. Eventually, we got 3 proposals after the final round, and then there were several teams of analysts, so we were some in Trondheim, some in Bergen, some elsewhere. We started looking at these systems, and we could break every one of them, obviously. It turns out that if you are an electronic voting vendor, you're selling something that's not very good. Well, basically. It's not perfectly true, but it is a very strong correlation between not being good and being sold by an electronic voting vendor. You should see all the press from the US, for instance. Is there a question? Do we want questions? Yes, so let's have a question. So the question is, did the project consult or use any of these normal software engineering standards like Common Criteria, etc.? Strictly speaking, yes. But there wasn't much time. There was 3 years from the project started till the election was going to happen. And I seem to remember that there was never time to do a proper common criteria evaluation. In fact, lack of time is something that's going to appear very prominently here in a few minutes. Anyway, we could break everything, but we also saw that 2 of these proposals, they were fixable, easily fixable. So then you can't kind of reject everyone. So and always in government procurement, you choose the cheapest when they're all good enough. And there was a partnership, there was a Spanish company, Cytel, it did the electronic voting that I'm interested in, and then Ergo did all the rest. I shall say that it's not the credit for being on time and under budget does not go to these two companies, it goes to the team that ran this project in the government. They were extremely good at what they were doing. If you ever are able to hire them, please do. I should also say that Cytel's crypto, it's this kind of crypto that you can't quite break, but you're so close. And you don't really trust it. So we replaced it. Let's look at what this system looks like. This is the traditional advanced voting. On paper, you put your ballot inside an envelope, you put that envelope inside another envelope, and you sign the outer envelope, put it in a ballot box. Eventually, someone takes all of these envelopes out, they discard the outer envelopes, and then they count the inner ones. And this kind of preserves your privacy, and it's very easy to do with integrity, blah, 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 blah. We want to do it electronically. And then if you give it to a bright student, you'll get this one. Because we have this thing called digital signatures, it basically looks like a signature. A very similar thing. We have this thing called public key encryption, and it basically looks like putting things in envelope, and someone else can open the envelope later on. So what happens is that you as a voter, you tell your computer you want to vote this or that. The computer encrypts your ballot using the election key. It signs it using your signature key. And then it passes everything on to an electronic ballot box. The electronic ballot box sits on all of these ciphertexts together with your name. And then when it's time to count, it simply discards the names and the signatures, and it passes all the ciphertext on to a guy that counts them. He decrypts, and then, I mean, these are electronic ballots. You can count them in no time at all. Decryption actually takes several minutes if you have a bunch of ballots. The point, of course, is that you can't let the ballot box cheat. You don't want to let the ballot box simply discard ballots. It can't make them up, if you're careful about it, because there are signatures involved. But the ballot box, we all know, at least where I grew up in Oslo, I know where the votes for the Conservatives come from, and I know where the votes for the Labour Party comes from. So if I'm a bit careful, I can just see where does this ciphertext come from, where does the guy who sent it in live, and if I want fewer votes for the Conservatives, I can just drop some of them from that area. So you have to prevent that. And what we did then is we introduced a second machine, what we call the return code generator. The ballot box, every time it receives something, it sends it on to this return code generator. The return code generator signs it with its own key, passes it back to the ballot box. The signature goes back to the voter's computer. The voter's computer checks that signature. And once it's checked that signature, that computer knows that the ballot has been in the ballot box. It has been in the return code generator. There are now two pieces of the infrastructure that has seen your ballot. We're confident that it got there. Okay. What happens now is that this ballot box, it was in Brønnøysund, and the return code generator was in Tønsberg. They were run by two completely different organizations, which means that it's more difficult to break the system. You have to break into both of these to be able to discard ballots. This is good for security, right? Okay, we have introduced a second guy here, this auditor, the glasses, because all auditors, they have glasses. I'm no good at drawing, so this is the best I could come up with. He is given everything from the ballot box, everything the ballot box has seen. He's given everything this return code generator has seen. And he simply compares them. And if they're the same, he knows that as long as one of them is honest, all the ballots that should be there, they're still there. Okay, then we get to this guy who decrypts. The really important thing is that he's not allowed to simply make things up. That's important. You can't just allow him to decrypt and say, oh, this is the result. Have a nice day. So he has to actually prove that he has done a correct decryption. And he has to prove that to the auditor. But the auditor knows these ciphertexts. He knows which ciphertexts belong to which voter. So if the decryption guy, he says simply this ciphertext decrypts to this one and here's a proof, the auditor will know how everyone voted, which is not good. We want privacy. So what happens is that the decryptor, he shuffles the ciphertext around and then he decrypts them. And then he says, these decryptions, that's a permutation of the decryption of these ciphertexts. I'm not going to tell you which ciphertext decrypts to what, but I'm going to prove to you that this is true. And then he uses really sophisticated cryptography, really interesting. I'm not going to talk about it. And the end result here is that you have actually four systems working together. In this case, the decryptor was run by the government department responsible, while the auditor was a guy hired, an election monitor, essentially. So you have four independent people, and if you can't corrupt too many of them, you're going to notice anything going wrong. This is good. There's, of course, one problem left. And let me emphasize that problem. Your computer. And this was the basic premise of the entire project. We're going to use your computer, but your computer is not secure. It's infected with all kinds of viruses and blah, blah. So we're going to have to deal with this. And a big part of the tender was, can anyone come up with something that's really good, a really good solution for this? And it turns out no one has a really good solution for this, but we have a solution. And this is what's known as return codes. So what happens, this return code generator somehow magically takes the ciphertext that you submitted, and without ever looking at something inside there, he produces what's known as a return code from your encrypted ballot. That return code is tied to your choice. And on your voting card, we all get these voting cards ahead of elections. And on the back of the voting cards of those who participated in these trials, there was a list. If you vote this party, you should get this code. So, when you vote, in this case, the Agrarian Party, what happens is that lots of magic crypto happens, and then you get a code. And that code should correspond to the Agrarian Party, should be on the back of your voting card. If you get a different code, you know something's gone wrong. These codes are, of course, different for everyone. So I would have one set of codes, someone else would have a completely different set of codes. And what happens now is that if your computer is full of these viruses and they decide, let's vote something else, let's not vote Agrarian, we don't like them, you're going to get a wrong return code, you're going to notice. And then there are some nice things with this system. You can vote multiple times. The BBC saw this and they realized you can vote multiple times. Isn't that a problem? Well, you don't have to count every vote. You only count the last one submitted. And also, we say that if you ever submit a paper ballot, that's the one we count. We discard all your electronic ballots. Which means that if you go to your computer, you tell it to vote this, and you get a wrong return code, you say, I'm not even going to try to fix this computer. I'm going to an election hall. I'm voting on paper. if you expect that you're going to be forced 3 minutes before the end of the deadline, forced to vote something by a helpful spouse or whatever, your local chess club, what you can do is you can go in plenty of time, just submit a paper ballot. And when the chess club shows up and they say, oh, we have some suggestions for you, you say, oh yes, I'll vote. Here, I'll show you. And you know that electronic ballot, it won't be counted. This is called a simple-to-use defense against coercion. So all of these properties come together to give us a reasonably secure system. Now, inside this system, there is lots of really nice cryptography. And I know because I designed lots of it. I'm just going to talk very briefly about how we design and how we prove these things secure. Because nowadays, 40 years ago, people sat with crypto systems, they put something together, they tried to break it, they couldn't break it, they said, oh, let's ship it. And, well, over the past 40 years, we've seen the results of that. So what we do today is that we try to prove that there can be no attacks. So I'll just show you just a really simplified example of how you would go about doing this. So this is the encryption of a ballot. We're using Elgamal. Those of you who have done a crypto course will know what this is about. And let's say that your computer, the ballot box, is curious about what you voted. It has narrowed it down to two different choices, and it wants to know which did you encrypt. Really wants to know that. Okay, so what we do is we play a game. Your computer is going to encrypt the ciphertext, then is going encrypt the ballot, it's going to get a ciphertext, then is going to give it to the ballot box. The ballot box is going to try to guess what's inside it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to make some changes to how the computer encrypts the ballot such that the ballot box can't tell the difference between, can't notice that I'm making these changes. And in the end, I'm going to get to a way to encrypt where the ballot box for sure cannot know anything about what I encrypted. And that means if it can't tell that I made all these changes, and at the end it can't tell what I encrypted, then it couldn't tell what I encrypted at the beginning either. Okay, when we only have two options, anyone can guess what I'm going to vote with probability 1/2. When we have these yes-no elections to the European Union, you can guess my vote with probability 1/2. Well, probably some of you can guess better than that, but 1/2. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to simply introduce another random number, and I'm going to change the computation. So this set, I'm going to compute it not with the R random number, I'm going to use the S random number. And then we have this thing called the decisional Diffie-Hellman assumption, which says that no one can notice this. Why do we believe in that? Well, we've spent the past 40 years studying that assumption. Some very good mathematicians have tried to break it. We know a lot of groups where we can break it, but if we're careful about the choice of group, we can't break this assumption, which means that this ballot box, he can't tell that I did this. Okay, so now we're left with this one. The ballot box is seeing the result of this. Now I'm going to make another change. I'm simply going to remove my ballot. And the argument here is that this set that I multiplied with my ballot to get the encryption, it's just a random value. And multiplying a random value with something, it doesn't really change anything. So just leaving it as a random value, completely unnoticeable. Right. And if you look carefully at what's left now, we have a situation where your computer encrypts the ballot in such a way that your ballot isn't even in the encryption anymore, which means that the encryption doesn't contain your ballot anymore, which means you can't tell what's encrypted in there. The ballot box has no idea what's going on anymore. And he couldn't tell that I made these changes, so he couldn't tell what I encrypted to begin with. Okay. This is slightly complicated. I'm giving it to you very, very without any preparation. So, but I just wanted to give you a slight idea. The real proof of this crypto system is slightly bigger. This was a very simple proof. Let me talk about the actual trial. So we have this nice, beautiful cryptography, and then along comes the developers, and they make something. And in 2011, this worked fairly well. The implementation worked well. There was this minor disaster. Somehow this printing of the voting cards went wrong. So a lot of voters, they got the wrong return codes, which is really great. And I'll explain why. They called and said, I got the wrong return code. And that's bad, of course. But the good thing is that we know people actually looked at these return codes. We know they used the mechanism that we built in that allowed them to check for bad things, and it worked. We weren't sure about that before we deployed the system. So, and of course, before the election, I always talked about, said it would have been beautiful if we could do this kind of trial during the election. And of course, even I realize you can't do that during an election. But when it happens by accident, oh, we're lucky. In hindsight, we're lucky. When they realized it happened, they were slightly angry with the printers. Okay, how did we do crypto? There is sophisticated crypto. It all happens in your browser. And how did you do that? Java applets. I think we by now have all forgotten them. But in 2009, these were a real pain. And I mean, this is a real problem. Ordinary people find it difficult to keep their Java installation working over time. And when the help desk for the election, one of the real problems they encountered was how to get Java working on the voter's computer. Now, the implementation, it hid this Java applet really well, so you wouldn't really notice it. But it was still there, and if Java didn't work, you couldn't vote. Bad thing. Right, so Java is the past. What's the future? That's JavaScript. How many of you know JavaScript? Of course you do. And it's awful. They say that inside JavaScript there's this really nice little language just waiting to get discovered. Well, there's a book written about it, JavaScript, the good parts, I think. But it's basically awful. But a huge amount of effort has been expended on the interpreters for JavaScript, and these browsers can now run JavaScript really quickly. So you can do crypto in JavaScript. It's really painful, but someone else has done the job, so you can do it. We've now gotten, of course, a new standard, web crypto, where you can do proper crypto in JavaScript really quickly. Unfortunately, it's no good for sophisticated crypto. It's good for the pedestrian stuff, but not for what we want to do. Random numbers. We all know they're important, really important for crypto. In fact, if you don't have random numbers, you can't do this. Random numbers are completely essential to hiding your ballot. And if you remember all the talks from 10 years ago, people said, you can't do crypto in JavaScript because we don't have random numbers, blah, blah. But then that changed right about, say, 2009. People came up with these entropy gathering demons. The browser vendors started to say, oh, maybe we should include a system call. We have all this nice pseudo-randomness lying around in the operating system anyway. Feeding it into the JavaScript, it's really simple. Let's just include a call. It's a different call for every browser, of course, but I mean, JavaScript, not so compatible when it all comes down to it. So there are some options you can use, but basically JavaScript randomness, it's a solved problem. Until these developers come along. They really want to implement this deterministic random bit generator, or a pseudo-random number generator, if you want to use that number. And there is an entire sub-industry of crypto designing these random generators. And they care about things such as state compromise. You want to recover from state compromise. You want to prevent backtracking. Lots of stuff. And if you look at this voting application, this is a small application. It runs for 2 minutes in your web browser while you're clicking and pressing vote. And if you look, think a bit about the requirements, the one thing you know is that this isn't going to need all of that fancy stuff for these generators. You can use the simplest construction you can think of, a block cipher, AES, encounter mode. And it's perfectly sufficient. Just clear the state after you're done. You anyway have to do that because you want to hide the ballot. Okay. Unfortunately, Seidel, they said, oh, let's do this properly. So they built this huge thing. It uses AES encounter mode, and then if you try to generate too much pseudorandomness, it's going to rekey. Every time you call the generator, it's going to rekey, and it's going to reseed every now and then, and it's all fancy stuff. Okay, I'm now going to show you some actual JavaScript code. And there are two bugs in it. One is just a bug. The other is the bug, which is going to bite me in a few moments. So, this is... it's a pretty standard code when you look at this. The code is too big to show you at all at the same time, so I have to show it to you in pieces. So first it starts by saying, if I don't have a key, so this is a JavaScript object, and it says, if I don't have a key already, I better get one. And that's okay. So it calls this, it basically just calls this entropy gathering daemon on the browser, and it asks for some randomness, and it gets it, and everything's well. It has a key. So now we can use AES encounter mode, and that's what it does here. And you notice, and this is a nice thing, it rekeys every now and then. And this is okay. Didn't have to do it this complicated, but okay. Never mind. And then they're done generating randomness. They're ready to return it to the caller, but they want to rekey before that. And look at this comment. It says, do it two times to ensure a key with 256 bits. And then you go back up and there you see, oh, last time they did it once. They built a generator that if you ask too much of it, it automatically degrades from a 256-bit security level to a 128-bit security level. From practical point of view, no need to care, but that's a bug. It's interesting. But anyway, did any of you see the bug, the one big one? It's not that easy to see, but once I point it out, you will see it, and you will go like, ooh. So, what happens with the key variable? That's the key material. What do they do when they want to generate a new key? They clear the key. And then they generate a new key. But now they start with an empty key. So they have this nice randomness, and then they clear it away, and then they say, okay, we have nothing, and then we generate a new key. And what's going to happen every single time? You're going to get the same key. So the first time you call this generator, you're going to get a nice random number. The next, every time afterwards, you're going to get the same random number. So this is a random number generator that throws a dice the first time you call it, and then it says 4, 4, 4, 4, 4. Actually, it's a Dilbert one, but never mind. So, I mean, this is... So, the point is that if you go to the JavaScript console and you say generate, and then you press up arrow and you say generate again, and then you say up arrow and you generate again, you've discovered the error. How's that for quality control? Right. We have a bit of randomness, but we don't have too much. We have one random number and that's it. What happens to our crypto when we have one random number and that's it? Well, this is the encryption. And for some various reasons that were reasonable, the system, when it encrypts, it discards roughly about half of the random numbers it generates. So half of all the encryptions, they were generated with the same random number. There was no security at all. I think this was discovered when someone took a bunch of ballots, put them into a spreadsheet, and pressed sort. And what happens is that you see all of these ciphertexts, and they're identical. And that was a kind of a problem. Unfortunately, this was discovered while the election was running. Not on the real numbers, but on test sets that had been available for months. But no one had had time to actually go look at this. I'll talk a bit about it later, but never mind. Anyway, half of the ballots were encrypted with a proper random number, but there was some crypto that came afterwards. And it turns out that crypto relies on random numbers as well, and when you use it with this fixed, known, everyone knows it random number, it kind of reveals the first random number. So it breaks your original good encryption, even when it wasn't broken. Isn't that nice? I built this crypto so that it would be nice, and I didn't expect this. I didn't plan for this. And it gets worse. For various reasons, we didn't really, we put a hash of this stuff on the web. And when there is no randomness involved, what happens is that the hash is determined purely by the choice, the voter's name, and his vote. So in principle, you could go on the web, look at these hashes, try some combinations of voter names and votes, and see if you find a match. That was bad. When I discovered this, I sent an email, and then I simply went home. I thought at that moment we had put 10,000 ballots in the clear on the web. That would have been bad. You would have heard about it. So it wasn't that bad. There was some randomness involved in the hash. Some proper randomness. Okay. So when it all came down to it, we had a complete crypto disaster, but it had no consequences. Okay, I include this picture of the hammer. It is a first step in destroying some sensitive data. I simply like the picture. There is a blender involved afterwards. Okay. I mean, there are. I'm not going to go into details about this, but there were some reasons why this didn't happen. If the same bug had appeared in 2011, there would have been time to find it, and it would have been found because a lot of things were done to actually look for this kind of thing. That wasn't done. About those return codes, I have 3 more minutes, so I'm just going to tell you why they don't work. Okay. So, I mean, the system, the voter is supposed to do this, but voters, well, they're people, and you know I don't like people, because they do this instead. They don't sit around waiting for an SMS. They go do something else, and then the SMS arrives, and maybe they do something, or maybe they don't. Right? So, what we tried to do was to look at what can we do with this. We have a lot of possible attacks against this kind of systems. And we want to use this mechanism to see, is there an attack? We can't protect everyone because voters, well, they're people, and people can't help them. But what you can do is try to detect something, and then you have some classical statistical problems. What you end up is you need some parameters that you need to actually measure. The best estimate we had was 90%. And that's, no one believes that number. That's the best estimate, but no one believes it. It's obviously wrong. But that's the best estimate. So what we did was a laboratory study. We gathered a bunch of students, we gave them mock-ups, we tried to bend over backwards so that they wouldn't actually pay attention to what they were doing, they would behave like normal voters, and then we exposed them to an attack, and we simply counted how many noticed. And we got a 10% notice rate, detection rate. Plausible, but these were ICT students that were self-reported to be reasonably good at computer security. 10% success rate for the best of the best. For the general population, strictly speaking, I had expected lower results, which is why we did it with ICT students. If I had gotten lower results, we could have concluded that it wouldn't work for the population in general. Now we can only suggest that it won't work. But still, you only need a few percent to actually be able to detect large attacks. So maybe it's not that bad, but we, strictly speaking, we don't know. Okay. Let me just make a very few concluding remarks. The current government doesn't care about electronic voting. That's the way it is. So the people who bought this system, ran it, except for one small bug, without problem.